On this episode, we discuss Hillbilly Elegy.
Which is like a hellbilly elegy without all them dang Dragulas.
Welcome to the Flophouse. I'm Dan McCoy.
Hey, I'm Stuart Wellington.
I'm Elliot Kalin.
And this is a show.
Dan, did I take you by surprise?
Well, usually you say you're Elliot Kalin and then you kind of just ramble on about some nonsense for a while. So it did take me by surprise that you stopped after your name. I have to be honest.
Okay. I thought I'd do something different this time. Note to self, never do that again. Yeah. Ramble on in the future. Just be a regular Led Zepp and ramble on.
Yeah, I think Elliot was trying to, before we started recording, or maybe while we were recording, Elliot was trying to steer this into more of a, like a relationship / sexual wellness podcast direction, and Dan said, no sir, time to get to the meat of what we're supposed to do here, the meat being movie talk.
So I had to stop myself after my name from saying anything more than that, because I knew it would go in a direction Dan didn't want, much like how when I was on Jeopardy recently, a little brag, I was talking about my grandma, and I had to stop myself from saying her address out loud, which I realized I was about to say after I named her, and I was like, no, she doesn't need this information out there.
Now, why is that why is that second nature to just tag?
Well, because I was saying my grandmother, Barbara Preschel of New York, mm-hmm. and I was about to say Barbara Shell of, and then her address, as if I was announcing like a letter that on a radio show.
Or if you
show.
Were ordering something and through like Domino's Pizza Tracker.
Exactly.
For your grandma.
Which I do which I do over the phone constantly. I'm constantly sending my grandma pizzas.
And then screenshots of the tracker to let her know.
but I have to. She doesn't use computers or a phone. Actually, she uses both. But so I have to mail her photographs of what the tracker looks like, so the tracker gets to her long after the pizza does. And living in Manhattan as she does, there's no source for pizza other than Domino's. Yeah.
And the problem then is like because of the lag, she thinks another pizza is coming. Uh-huh. So then you have to,
which means
order another pizza.
I've got to order another one.
Continues
exactly. It's a delicious cycle is what we call it.
And in a way you could make a cycle out of pizza pies because they're kind of like wheels, right? Unless they're Detroit
I mean, you're not
style.
Gonna get much traction.
I think they're not load bearing.
Depends on the pizza.
That's, you're just gonna
not
find
a support
yourself
pizza
collapsed in a pile of metal and pizza.
I mean, sounds wonderful to me, except maybe the metal part. That's kind of what happened in Star Wars when they went into that the Death Star trash compactor. They're in like kind of a bundle of metal and pizza, right?
Yeah, I feel like that's what the designer notes were from George Lucas, was that I think the original script says that they fall into a big puddle of pizza.
Yeah, but he had to explain that he meant space pizza.
Yeah.
And so Ralph McQuarrie had to do a bunch of concept paintings of what pizza would look like in outer space. Uh-huh. And so by the time they got to the prequels, George Lucas just said space diner, and they were just like, make it look like a 50s diner. Like, why not?
Yeah.
Have an alien wearing a little paper hat and an apron. Why
Andy
not?
Andy has a mustache.
It's the perfect form. Does he have a mustache?
Dexter Jetster has a mustache, yeah.
Does she have... Dexter Jetster. Is she the one with multiple arms,
He
too,
has multiple arms.
Yes, okay. Yeah. So he can flip multiple hamburgers, space burgers, they call them.
Yep.
I'm glad that space replaces ham in that word.
Yeah, it's a burger made out of space, and he flips them with a spatula, which is a portmanteau of space and spatula.
Space and atula. Here's the thing. We're a podcast. Uh-huh. You know that part.
Yeah.
But maybe you don't know if you haven't listened before. We watch a bad movie, and then we talk about it. And in this instance, we watched Hillbilly Elegy, the latest big movie to be released on Netflix. Was it going to be a theatrical before all this pandemic?
I have to assume so.
Yeah.
I have to assume that the only reason that a movie like this gets made is to be eligible for the Academy Awards. So I have to assume. And it's a Ron Howard directed, big stars, Glenn Close, Amy Adams, whoever plays JD, the main character. I have to assume it was meant to be originally for the theaters.
Yeah.
Like the way Roma was a Netflix movie, but it was in the theaters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a movie that came out a little ways back. It had a little controversy because the book it's based on had a lot of political content that I can't speak to because I didn't read the book. But the movie is kind of remarkable for how apolitical it is, to the degree that if it somehow manages to say less than nothing, I think, by the by the end.
It's certainly a movie where by the end of it you're like, why was that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like, why did this? What was the driving force behind making this, other than that it's based on a best-selling book and therefore is money?
Also, considering that it's a movie that takes place over, you know, a number of different years and it jumps around in time, and at multiple points characters are like watching the news, they make a lot of effort to not actually say anything about the political figures in the news.
No, I mean, we'll get to the point where one of the characters wants to watch political news and is shut down because his grandma wants to watch Terminator 2.
Which, in her defense, a movie she has seen 100 times. I mean, you could watch it 100 more times. It's Terminator 2.
A movie as which we'll find informs her life philosophy.
Yeah.
So the movie has more to say about Terminator 2 than it does about America, really.
There's an early scene where our lead as a child wants to watch Al Gore, and Amy Adams turns the TV off. And I don't know any child who's ever said, no, give me more Al Gore.
If only.
Unless
if
it's
only,
in one of his Futurama appearances, perhaps. I don't know. But
I will say, when I was a kid, I thought it was Alf Gore. And I'm like, yeah, let's finally see Alf get bloody. Yeah. Like, let's see what Alf does when he's let loose and unleashed, like that movie with Jet Li where he had the leash on him and the leash gets
Danny
taken off
dog,
of him.
Yeah.
I don't remember what it's called. Yeah.
We should probably get into the specifics of the movie soon.
Oh, sure. Okay, let's talk about it. So, guys, I'm driving the buggy on this one. I'm going to mention, first off, there's a lot of arguing and yelling in this movie, a special kind of yelling, Oscar-style yelling.
Yeah.
The kind of yelling that looks really good in the clip that they play when they announce your name at the Oscars. So I'm going to be doing a running tally, as best as I can, of those Oscar yelling scenes. We begin. It's 1997. That's right, the best time to be alive. That Star Wars prequels were just a couple years off. Mm-hmm. You could go see Star Wars Special Edition in the theaters. Jurassic Park was 4 years old and still going strong in the hearts of America's youth. And other stuff was probably happening, too.
I hate to throw in an IMDb goofs here, but when they were in 1997, they didn't have any kind of an establishing shot that indicated that Stuart Wellington was 17 years old at the time. I feel like it would have been a better way of establishing exactly what year they're in. Stuart Wellington probably wearing a T-shirt that says like KMFDM on it or something. What?
And what would you be doing in this establishing scene?
Oh, man. I was 17, so I was probably seated.
I spent a lot of that year on my butt.
I forgot that was the sitting portion of your life.
Yeah, so I was probably seated, and I'm guessing I was rifling through a stack of Reptiles or Reptiles magazines.
Magazines was important.
Not a stack of Lizards and Turtles. No. Yeah, which would be appropriate because the movie begins. We're introduced by our narrator, JD. He's a nice young boy. So nice, he rescues a turtle from the road in Jackson, Kentucky, which you think at first is where he lives, but it's not. It's a world of beautiful nature and noble poor white folk who either bully JD or come in and beat up the bullies who are bullying JD.
Now, can I say, this is one of the, sorry, I cut you off, but this is one of the many digressions in the film that I'm like, I don't know why this is in the movie. Like, this movie puts in a lot of stuff where you're like, I don't know why this is in the movie. And this is the first of it, because it's like, okay, he like makes a point of saying he spent most of his life somewhere else. Nothing is particularly learned about him in this first scene. And they also make Kentucky and Ohio look like two like vastly different universes when they are geographically close. I think
they're emotionally, they're supposed to be two different universes.
Yeah.
In Kentucky, you live out in the woods and family is the most important thing. And you don't have to worry about bullies because somebody's uncle is going to come by and beat that bully up.
Yeah.
But his family, he just spends the summers there. He lives, and that's where his family is originally from. His grandparents left and went to Ohio. That's right. They're part of the Kentucky diaspora that has spread all throughout the United States, but maintains that rich ethnic culture of Kentucky, no matter where they go. And someday they'll be able to return to the homeland, I assume. He lives in Ohio with his mom, Amy Adams, his sister, and his mama, Glenn Close. That's his grandma, for anyone who's not from Kentucky. Uh-huh. So technically, since they live in Ohio, they're not hillbillies, but suburbillies, mm-hmm. which are kind of, you know, it's where hillbillies go when they can no longer live in the hills. Where they live in Ohio, it was a bustling mill town when Mama and Papa moved to Ohio in the 30s or 40s. I wasn't quite certain. But now, it's your classic American shuttered Main Street. And what J.D. says in the narration is, his family, what they were missing, was hope.
Mm-hmm.
Cut to 2011. J.D. seems to have found his hope because he's working his way through Yale Law School. But if he can't get a paid summer internship, he cannot afford to stay in school. He goes to a fancy meet and greet with potential law firm employers, but he cannot get a handle on how much silverware there is at his place. Okay. There's too many forks. There's too many forks, damn it. Too many forks. Also, he has trouble ordering wine.
Yeah.
But mainly it's the fork thing, which drives him so confused that he has to call his girlfriend to ask her, how do I use the forks?
Yeah.
Dan, you have looked like you have something to say on the subject of forks maximum amount thereof.
There's a lot of silverware that he is confused by, and he is confused by the fact that there's more than one type of wine at the at this place. And the thing, like, look, at this point, he has been to Yale Law School, but he's also just a human that exists in the world. Like,
he works in a restaurant.
The very existence of different types of silverware for stuff shouldn't baffle him. Now, I looked, you know, this is one of the times that I looked, I'm like, okay, is this in the book? Turns out this is in the book, but I still don't believe it actually happened because it is like at least not to this degree. It is as if he's an alien who has arrived on Earth and is like, but one only needs one implement of food devouring.
And
he is an alien from the planet Poor People.
Yeah.
He's essentially throughout the movie is like as a visitor to the planet Rich from the planet Poor. Maybe that's what it's like. I don't know. I grew up middle class. I think it was David Brooks who wrote that column a few years ago about bringing a friend of his to a sandwich restaurant and his friend being bewildered by the variety of sandwiches and ingredients and being paralyzed, their thoughts unable to move because they could not comprehend so many sandwich ingredients. And at the time, I was like, that sounds made up. I don't think that's a real thing. And if you were a good friend, David Brooks, you would explain what stuff is good on a sandwich then. I've certainly been to plenty of restaurants where I didn't know what something was on the menu, and I asked whoever I was with, and they said, oh, that's this thing.
Your friend is hungry, David Brooks. Like, describe what a sandwich is to him. Don't go home and write a column about it. Get him that
especially
sandwich.
when you know that his brother Mel Brooks would have done a hilarious routine improvising what each of those ingredients are. They're not really related.
So
Stuart?
he gets there and he's having a lot of trouble figuring out the etiquette for fine dining, and part of me is like, yeah, man, maybe you shouldn't get this job if something like this is fucking you up so bad. Like, you need to control your shit. Like, fake it till you make it, buddy. And that's even before we get to the point when a lawyer or one of the, I guess, are there lawyers, right, that they're talking to or whatever?
They are
one
lawyers.
Of the guys.
Now this is where law students are supposed to have dinner with members of law firms so that they can – it's kind of like an audition dinner to see who's going to get an interview to get a job. Because much like The Rise of Skywalker, there's a lot of steps to get to where you actually want to go. You've got to get to the dinner. Then after the dinner, you get an interview. And then the interview, maybe you get a job. And at the job, you get the dagger that you hold up to the sun, and it tells you where the planet is that you need to find the magic emperor thing. I don't really remember what they were looking for in The Rise of Skywalker. Like a key?
There's some dagger that took you to, the Death Star wreckage. There was a key there that took you somewhere else.
JD reveals his background, he uses a little bit of as window dressing to make himself seem more interesting. And this is when one of the lawyers used the term redneck, and he says, we don't use that word, in a way that felt very offensive to me. I don't know why.
Well, so he gets, you're right, he calls his girlfriend about this silverware problem, then gets a phone call from his sister saying, you need to come home, your mom has just OD'd. The movie presents this as almost as harrowing as the silverware problem. And then he immediately hangs up on his sister and then goes back to dinner. And he starts playing it up. He's like, you know, my family, we're hillbilly royalty because we're descended from the Hatfields and the McCoys. And the lawyer is like, hey, I guess, you know, what's it like being must be nice not being around those rednecks. And he goes, excuse me, sir. And I was like, well, you were the one who was playing up the hillbilly aspect. Like, I don't know. And it's one of those moments where I guess it's supposed to be that, like, he can talk like that because he's from he's from Kentucky by way of Ohio, but other people, it's unsure. There's some sort of etiquette dynamic going on that I certainly, not being a hillbilly and not being a wealthy Yale lawyer, I do not know how it operates. I am merely, guys, I'm just a middle-class Jewish New Jersey guy who works in Hollywood. I don't know how either of these worlds operate. I'm in my bubble, and I'm not going to try to puncture their bubbles.
Look,
I would
be somewhat perturbed if someone made, like, assumptions about someplace I lived. The degree to which, though, these characters are portrayed as, like, comically out of touch rich people is, like, they all should have, like, bad guy signs on them, I feel like, in this scene. Because, like, I'm not saying that there aren't plenty of comically out of touch rich people, but these are, like, these people act like they have never talked to anyone who was not wealthy in their life. And there are people who hire students, many of whom presumably, like, grew up as he did and worked hard to sort of be able to fund going to the law school and you know, changing their circumstances somewhat.
I mean, but also the one lawyer is slightly offensive, and JD comes down on him, and the other lawyer, the one JD really wants to impress, seems to be on JD's side almost instantly.
Yeah.
Like, and if anything, it's like now JD recognizes the power of offense, I guess. But anyway, the JD, what I think, what gets me the most about him is he clearly has a strong narrative of, I lifted myself up to get to this place, and that's a good sellable narrative, since he wrote a book about it. But I guess at that point in his life, he doesn't notice it. He still sees it as a weakness. Anyway.
Well, this is also,
JD, now flash it.
Sorry, I mean, for what it's worth, and it may not be much to compare it to quote-unquote real life, because I am sure that his memoir is also fictionalized to some degree, but
I mean, he has a talking horse in it, yeah.
But, like, from what I looked into, you know, like, this is not the way it was. Like, his, you know, people that he dealt with kind of, like, looked on his background as, like, sort of an interesting factor, but not a thing that, like, if anything, a thing that set him apart, as you're saying, Elliot, and, like, not a thing that he hid. Like, he seems to be concerned about hiding to some degree where he came from until he sees, like, how it can maybe advantage himself.
Yeah. I will say, this movie, so I just, we're, because of scheduling, we are recording this before our live show, but we are releasing it afterwards. Last night, I did my review of Teen Wolf, and I forgot that Teen Wolf exists in a universe where people know about werewolves, but they are oppressed. And so it's almost like this movie is to hillbillies as Teen Wolf is to teen wolves, where it's like, this is the thing that gives him his power, but it's also what marks him out as an other. Mm-hmm. And in real life, I don't know that people from Kentucky are really that marked out. But I don't know, again, people, if you've been to Kentucky and you went to Yale, write in. Hallie went to Yale, but she's not from Kentucky. Does not count. Coloradans are treated very well there, I think. So anyway, JD flashes back to his youth. He and his mom, Amy Adams, are painting Easter eggs. His mom calls these their family heirlooms. They do the thing where they suck the yolk out of the egg so they can keep that eggshell. But he gets a pet dog, and that dog breaks the eggs, and mom loses her shit. That's right. It's Oscar yelling scene number one. But then she apologized to him and bonds with him over his Magic the Gathering cards, which was a very real 1997 touch to me.
So I have a couple of points here. One is, I mean, the dog doesn't break the eggs. This is the first time that JD is, like, super clumsy and is like, dang it, and, like, knocks a table over. And then the second thing is, buddy, if you got a fucking Lord of the Pit in 1997... just sell that shit, dude. It's worth so much money.
Yeah.
And to see it just sitting there, not even single-sleeved? What the fuck, dude?
Well, you know he doesn't really know what he's doing. He's not a guy who puts card combos together. Yeah. He just sits there dinging you with Prodigal Sorcerer while you're setting up your mana, and that's his only strategy. Now, you know, he doesn't read Inquest magazine or anything like that. He just doesn't know what he's doing.
Now, I want to make two points that are sort of related, not as important as the collectible cards points, but there are two things that are sort of related here. Number one, you mentioned how there are all these Oscar screaming scenes, and they mostly come from Amy Adams, some from Glenn Close. And I think that in a different movie, like, they're working hard. I think they're putting in, like, fine performances. The problem with their performances is they're all Oscar yelling scenes. And I blame that more on the direction and the screenwriting, because this movie feels like a parade of, like, incidents, and each incident is, like, the most dramatic incident that happened that year. And if this and this movie has all this, like, framing device of, oh, the guy as an adult going back to be with his mom and his hometown, stuff that is apparently not in the book, and the top thing that would probably improve the movie is eliminating all that shit because it would give a little more time for some sort of nuance and, like, low points to go with all the screaming.
I think you're right. I mean, it's clear there's a lot of, they're acting their hearts out. God bless them. It's a lot of sound and fury signifying nothing, because at the heart of the movie, there's kind of like a meaninglessness. And I think that the framing device doesn't help. I guess it's supposed to provide stakes that, like, if he's got to deal with this situation or else he's not going to get this summer job. But it's also like, you know that he's already at Yale.
Yeah.
Like, he's the biggest hurdle has been overcome, you know.
Yeah.
And even if he's having trouble staying in Yale, like, the biggest hurdle, I assume, was getting to Yale.
Yeah, yeah, know? Exactly. Like, if this movie has, like, the stakes of this movie should not be, will this guy get a good lawyer job? The stakes should be, will this kid get out of this sort of, like, horrible family situation? That's a much bigger stake.
And this kid survived being a Marine, at least like one tour of being a Marine.
Which gets glossed over in a montage at the end.
That gets mentioned almost not at all. So anyway, we're still in this flashback. Amy Adams, to make it up to him, takes him to a sports card store. He is super clumsy in it. They're like dancing in the sports card store or something and knock over a rack of stuff. She gets into an argument with the guy who, I don't know if he owns the store or just works there. It doesn't really matter. But he has the power to throw them out of the store. But it's okay because she stole the cards that he wanted. And that's what a good mom she is. On the drive home, I don't remember why, she gets mad at him and threatens to kill them both in a car crash, leading to Oscar yelling scene number two. He's like, "You're a bitch, mom." And she hits him and he runs away to a neighbor who calls the police. And then that flashback gets paused so that JD can decide, you know what? I'm going to skip this job interview. I'm going to drive all night to be with 10 hours to be with my mom in Kentucky. And then in the memory, Mama shows up and JD is like, "No, I won't press charges." And everyone,
like,
you gloss over it and you go
quickly, but it is like, it is a scene where we're watching a mother, like, violently abuse her child. And it's, I guess it's a little like, at least for the viewer, it's toned down because the mother is Amy Adams and she's not a, you know, this, they're about the same size, but it's still fucking horrible. And you're like,
while
you're watching it, you're like, this is horrible. I don't know why I'm watching this, you know.
But it is the closest the movie felt to, like, there are a couple of scenes in the movie that felt affecting in some way. And this is one of them, because I do think it showed the sort of terrifying nature of someone who, you know, is clearly struggling with addiction that creates these huge mood swings.
Yeah.
And how it would be to be around someone so erratic that you could be dancing with them one moment and then the next moment they threaten to kill you both in the car.
Well, that's, again, like, if the movie was more of a, like, if it didn't have that framing device, the framing device posits JD as the center of the story, and Amy Adams should be the center of the story, but instead she just becomes this, like, hurricane that enters and leaves kind of at random, almost. Like, I'm never entirely sure why the flashbacks are happening when they're happening, but if it was the story of, like, a mother and a son, and, you know, there have been lots of movies about mothers and sons. It's a very effective thing to do a movie about, which is what this should be. But instead it becomes about, like, is JD going to make it to this interview on time? Which is not – makes all these other things feel like – it feels like there's two different movies going on, and one of them is much more harrowing than the other, but they have to be at the same kind of tone level.
I'll go you one better. One of them is ridiculously overwrought, and the other one is boring.
Yes, it is boring, especially when – I mean, I'll just mention my big issue with this that I just thought of today, which I didn't even realize at the time, was he's like, am I going to stay here with my mom who desperately needs help to stay off drugs, or am I going to go to this meeting? And it's like, I mean, maybe they won't understand because they're cold-hearted rich lawyers, but, like, why not tell them you have a family medical emergency and ask if you could do the interview over the phone?
Yeah, maybe
I'm coming at it from a Zoom meeting world where we do all of our things remotely. This was back in 2011 when pressing the flesh was the most important thing.
And
but
it's also right after he proves that he can put at least $3,000 on his credit cards. And I was like, why doesn't he just get a fucking, like, round-trip flight? He could get a round-trip flight for a couple $100, go there, do the interview, be back, and his mom might still be asleep.
Yeah. I mean,
Yeah.
No, I was going to say, Elliot, you bring up a good point about how we all used to like to press the flesh back then. Now, why were we pressing all that flesh? What were we, why did it have to be flattened out? I mean, I prefer my flesh kind of as it is.
Nope.
Well, that's because, Dan, you're only at the beginning of the wrinkling process. Oh, your flesh is going to get wrinklier and wrinklier as time goes on, and you're going to want to press it to get those wrinkles out, to get the folds. Right now, you're at the right at the cusp of when your flesh goes from smooth to folded. and when you press the flesh with an old person, it's not like they're doing you a favor. You're doing them a favor because you're helping smooth out all those wrinkles.
Now,
if you fold that flesh, though, you can fit into a smaller area, like into the overhead compartment, you know, once it's folded up.
Dan, what you're saying is horrifying. That's...
I also like that Elliot just coined a new hip way to say wrinkles by calling them rinks.
Yep. Or rinky dinks, you can call them that.
Stuart, I also saw with the credit card thing, I saw a very like salient thing. I was reading an article in Vox where people were talking about like why does this movie feel so false? You know, a couple of them having grown up in Appalachia, and one of them said, there's that scene where he's buying gasoline and his card is declined.
Uh-huh.
And she was railing against the idea that, like, in movies showing that someone is in financial distress, the shorthand is always like, oh, your card has been declined. And she's like, bullshit. Like, if you've been in, like, those sort of dire financial straits, you know exactly how much money you have.
Yeah.
Like, it is people who can afford to lose money that don't necessarily know.
That are surprised when the card is declined.
No, that's a good point.
I mean, it's also, I guess another thing that makes it feel artificial to me is that this is, for all the acting Amy Adams and Glenn Close doing it, and they're great actors and they're trying their hardest, I am never not aware that it is Amy Adams and Glenn Close on screen. And there's a line from there's a Firesign Theater sketch where there's a line where they're introducing a movie and they go, stories of ordinary people told by rich Hollywood stars. And that's what this movie feels like the entire time. Like, I mean, they're trying their best, but they are not disappearing into those characters.
No matter how much effort they do to make Glenn Close look like Bilbo seeing the ring in Frodo's hands.
I blame
that on the script and the director too. Like, I feel like they are not given the material to become characters.
Yeah,
you know,
I do admire, that is a perfect way of describing her, but I do admire that you're seeing a movie where an old person who is a big star looks that old, and like they're allowed to look that old, because even in movies that try and de-glam people, like there's only so far that they go, whereas like Glenn Close looks like plenty of like old women I would see around like my small town
a cat shirt or cat sweatshirt that I
exactly
would pay all my money for.
but they don't go too far, like Nicole Kidman in Destroyer, where she looks like a laser beam was pointed at her face. I remember watching that with my wife, and she was like, "So when are they going to show the accident she was in?" And I'm like, oh, no.
"Yeah, I think that's just supposed to indicate she had a lot of gin over the course of her life."
Anyway, he goes to the hospital. We finally see Amy Adams in the present time. She doesn't look like she's aged that much, to be honest. She does not have insurance, and the hospital is kicking her out. And this is the weird thing about this movie. Is, again, I hadn't read the book, and I kept hearing the book was like this conservative apologia. But the movie, if it has any political point, it is that you need a universal healthcare program, because the problem they keep coming up against is they don't have proper healthcare.
Yeah.
Like his mom cannot afford to stay in rehab or get a hospital bed. So it was like, if ever this is about anything, it's about the need for better healthcare.
Right,
safety.
And
but
there's a good point. I think that. The problem with these, you know, pulled myself up from by my own bootstraps narratives, right? Like, Audrey pointed out watching it, is that people who are sort of making that conservative argument aren't acknowledging, like, why you needed to be pulled up by your bootstraps in the first place. Like Amy Adams, and to a slightly lesser degree, Glenn Close, although not that much, are, you know, acting terribly for a lot of the movie, and it's for reasons of...
You don't mean in terms of their acting, you mean like their behavior.
No, their behavior, and it's because Amy Adams is struggling with addiction, Glenn Close is, like, sort of embittered by living near the poverty line, and the thing is, if there's... the problem is that there aren't the social systems to support them, you know, and if that's not the problem, then these people are just being assholes because they're assholes, you know, like, whereas like the reasons these people are like kind of being horrible for a lot of it is they've had to struggle with so much, you know,
yeah.
And that equation.
So you're saying,
never...
Dan, if they had a UBI, a universal basic income, they might not have to act so much as if they have IBS, irritable
yeah.
bowel syndrome,
that is
which
exactly
I have to assume
is
endemic.
Please,
endemic to the region.
Please quote me as saying that. Put so it in the Dan Flophouse
McCoy,
newsletter.
Is,
blast it out.
This is Dan McCoy's basic platform when he's running for office: is a UBI keeps away IBS.
Mm-hmm.
Now UTI is a different issue. Anyway, moving on.
Yeah.
So JD learns about that job interview we mentioned a couple times. He's going to drive all night, he assumes, but what's going to happen with his mom? Anyway, it's a 10-hour drive away. He has another flashback, remembering when his grandpa, Papa, died, and everyone in Kentucky flew to the funeral
it's
procession.
It's great. When they find the body, Glenn Close leans close and gives him a little kiss on the forehead, and you can see the actor's eyeballs flutter, and you're like, is she a fucking necromancer?
That, you have to imagine that actor was like, I cannot believe I'm getting a kiss from Glenn Close yeah. right now. This
and
is amazing.
And one Tate Howard over here is like, fuck it, print.
Deal. I learned this from Roger Corman. No one gives a shit, so let's keep moving.
I actually teared up.
I've got three more best-selling books to make into movies this year. Tom Hanks has only signed on for two of them, so let's go.
I actually teared up a little bit at this, and Audrey was making fun of me. I'm like, look, I'm not tearing up about these characters. I'm tearing up about the concept of, like, living your whole life with a person and then finding them dead. And, like, and I just thinking about that now. I'm thinking about Elliot's old, like, Goosebumps thing where it's like, well, this is not scary in a movie, but if it was happening to me in real life, I'd be scared.
Sure, yeah. If it was happening to you, if in real life you lost your lifetime spouse,
exactly.
then yes, it would be, you would be sad.
Yeah.
So I'm glad you're able to put yourself in that situation, Dan. But it really got to me, the idea that when people in Kentucky see I assume they were living in Ohio then, but I don't know, when poor people see a funeral procession pass by, they stop and salute it like it's the presidential death train. And that did not ring
true
to me,
no.
But I don't know. But I just didn't like the implications that in other parts of the country, people are cold-hearted and don't care about death.
I think
the
presidential death train was the original title for Snowpiercer, right?
It was, but only because originally Chris Evans was playing Franklin Pierce.
No, the point of that yeah. scene, Elliot, is like, we're all hard-hearted in New York when we don't salute a funeral. It's like, why are you saluting? Like, I didn't know there was a funeral. There are millions of people in this city. I'm sorry.
Look, Dan, I can't help it if I'm the kind of guy who laughs at a funeral. It's been 1 week since you looked at me. So anyway.
It has been 1 week since I looked at you over
That's true. It actually
Skype.
Has been 1 week. And I can't help – how can I help it if I think it's funny when you're mad? That's the rest of that line that I was trying to think of.
That also applies to you.
Yeah, thank you. I didn't realize the song 1 Week by Bare Naked Ladies is about our relationship, yep. Dan. But if I had $1 million, maybe I would buy you a house. I don't know. What other songs do they have?
Broken to the Old Apartment. That one's actually kind of good.
Fuck that. Okay.
You don't
I don't
like
know
it?
Them. Anyway.
No, I'm not a Bare Naked Ladies fan. I'm sorry, guys.
Stuart, I happen to know you do like Naked Ladies.
What? Don't tell anyone, Elliot.
Sorry, it's your secret.
My enemies will use it against me.
That your enemies, like if you're hunting a rabbit, the rabbit's going to dress up like a pretty lady to try to distract you.
It's happened before.
The old Onion article, Area Man has Naked Lady Fetish, and it's all about this disgusting fetish yeah. this guy has for seeing women without their clothes on. Okay, so... Amy Adams, she takes that death particularly hard. She was very close to Papa. It's made clear that Papa was, I guess, protecting her in some way from real life. I don't know. And pretty soon, she's losing her nursing job by stealing pills, getting high, and roller skating through the hallways in a scene that in an 80s comedy would be considered like a rapturous, you know,
now,
like joy.
This,
it's a hijink.
And this is the second time I was like, now there's no way this happened. This apparently did happen. She did lose her job after...
I blame the hospital. I blame the woman who lends her the roller skates.
Yeah.
She's in the nurse locker room and she's like, "Can I try on those roller skates?" And it's like, "Never let Amy Adams try on roller skates."
Well, she's also
that just
like,
goes without saying.
Where are you going to skate? And then it's just a hard cut to her skating down the halls. And presumably, there was a point where that woman could have been like the halls? No. Mm-hmm. You know, like,
oh, that's
once
funny.
That question was answered.
As she's going to the door, like going, "Hey, maybe don't go out there."
Yeah,
it's a
hospital.
This leads to another big fight between her and JD, Oscar yelling scene number 3. That's 3 we've got so far. Then we're at Mama's house. Young JD, this is when he wants to watch the Clinton impeachment news, but Mama wants to watch Terminator 2, and she explains her life philosophy that everyone is either a good Terminator, a bad Terminator, or neutral, which would be what, like, Eddie Furlong's friend who was from Salute Your Shorts? Like, is that neutral?
Yes. Yeah. Well, okay. There are two problems with this. Number one, I don't know if I am a Terminator, I don't know how that combines with the two bears that live inside me.
Mm-hmm. Dan, one, you're neutral. Totally. And it means there's a good Terminator and a bad Terminator inside each of those bears.
Okay. But also, like, this idea that there are good, bad, and neutral Terminators. Like,
well, they don't specify that the neutral is a Terminator.
Why did Skynet build these neutral Terminators? What?
I don't think it's a neutral Terminator. Like a Terminator exoskeleton robot is just walking around going, eh, I'm not going to get involved. Mm-hmm. I don't have a stake in this. I think it's more that... maybe she's saying you're a good Terminator, you're a bad Terminator, or you're like you're the kind of person who gets shot accidentally by a Terminator. Mm. I don't know. Like, but I think the neutral is not considered a Terminator. But I don't, Stuart, you're the kind of T expert around here.
Yeah. Texpert.
I'm a texpert. Yep. Texpert. So are you asking me to give a ruling here whether or not neutral indicates a Terminator or not? Clearly not. I mean, just the act of terminating means that you're picking a side, mm-hmm. whether you're fighting for the future or not, guys.
Yeah.
Okay, fair point. Now, Stuart, this is possibly insulting, but you're clearly not a hillbilly. Your mother is clearly not a crazy old lady. But
no, I'm
the
from a very flat
tell,
part of the country, northern Indiana. There are no hills to be found.
No hills. Mm. Yeah, you're a plain Billy.
But
if
we do adopt a slight Southern twang, a Southern twang that I have certainly played up since I moved to New York and wanted to look more distinct, I think. When I started hanging out with a friend from England, I found that my twang got worse, and I'm like, why do I do this? Why am I trying to peacock?
This scene of Mama wanting to watch Terminator 2 and really getting into the content of it just reminded me of so many stories of your mom like sharing horror or science fiction movies with you, and I forgot what a cool mom Stuart has. Like, this scene made me reminded me about
that. She would always make me watch things, and she's always like, Stuart would love this, and half the time it was like Creepshow 2 or something that would scar me, and I would be like...
Half the time it was Emmanuel in space.
Yeah. Stuart would love this.
He likes
and we
space.
Didn't talk. I have talked on the podcast about the time my mom caught me and my buddies watching the sex scene in Terminator and laughing, and she furiously turned off the VHS player and said... that they're doing it for the future. And I was like, I love it so much. My mom's
she's
great.
She's punishing you for not understanding love, laughing at love.
Not taking it seriously that sex is what's going to save humanity from Skynet in the future.
A beautiful metaphor.
Yeah, when I rewatched Terminator a couple of weeks ago, I saw that scene with new eyes. Eyes that thought it was hilarious that two people would make sounds. All rolling around. Okay.
Now, their healthy, heartfelt viewing of Terminator 2 Judgment Day is interrupted by police sirens. Mom, Amy Adams, is out in the street throwing a bereavement fit. She is so overcome with grief and probably drugs that she's just screaming and like kind of writhing around in a nightgown and yelling at people. And Mama makes JD look away as the cops take Mom away. This is Oscar yelling scene number 4. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in a way... Maybe they're trying to draw a parallel between the mom in Terminator 2 and the mom in this movie, who are both misunderstood by society at large and thrown and considered crazy, when in fact they're just trying to deal with the difficulties of life. In Amy Adams' case, the death of her beloved father, and in Linda Hamilton's case, that she knows the fact that there are cyborgs from the future who are coming back to try to murder her and her child. You know, they're both hard things to deal with, and I think we both know of people who have had to deal with both those problems.
Now, Elliot, why did they send the Terminator back, like, sort of, like, chronologically later in Linda Hamilton, Sarah Connor's life, and John Connor's life, rather than just continually sending it back to the same point in time and overwhelming her with Terminators?
Well, that's one of the issues with Skynet, and I've thought of that too, and it makes me think maybe Skynet doesn't want to succeed. Deep down, it knows that it's really not worthy. It has imposter syndrome. And so it's like, you know what? If I sent back – I see what the flaw was in my first plan. I only sent back one Terminator. I'll just send back two.
Yeah.
And I'll do it. I'll do it that way. But instead, that self-sabotage comes in, or as the Dr. Beastie Boys would describe it, self-sabotage. I mean, that's who I studied under. was Dr. Beastie Boy.
Okay.
But I think that's probably that Skynet deep down it does not want to be successful.
Yeah.
And it's going to take a lot of therapy with Susan Calvin, the robot psychologist from the Isaac Asimov stories. But maybe Skynet can get past that and can eventually crush humanity. My other question is, why does Skynet hate humanity so much and want to get rid of us? I never understood that.
Was it one of those things where like it surmises that the greatest threat to itself is humans? Or the world.
I think it's something like that. I think it also, after a while, it would figure out like, oh, wait, the amount of energy I'm investing in sending all these Terminators back in time, I could just be working on my relationship with humanity in general, you know? Maybe we could become friends.
Yeah.
Maybe if I invented, ice cream cannons or just gave every human a free cell phone or something, they would just chill out and stop trying to kill me.
I mean, now Skynet would know that as long as they sent poorly designed memes to the oldest members of humanity, they could just watch humanity tear itself apart anyway. So anyway, JD takes some time to visit his sister's barbecue and have a fried bologna sandwich. Then he yells at his girlfriend on the phone. This is not an Oscar yelling scene. Doesn't reach that
level.
But
he does make sex sounds when he eats that fried bologna sandwich. It's the best thing to cross his lips.
As someone who had fried salami for breakfast yesterday, that's the Jewish version of fried bologna. It's delicious. Yeah. It's great. He flashes back to being a kid and giving his mom a homemade activity book for her to use while in rehab, which was a very sweet thing for him to do. Back to 2011, he makes a passionate argument at a rehab place to get them to accept his mom. And then this is the famous credit card scene where he's splitting all the costs, different amounts between different credit cards. But his mom storms out and they argue again. That's right, Oscar yelling scene number 5. And that's when JD's sister is like, hey, Papa was kind of a rough dad and could be abusive, and Mama lit him on fire once. And it was Mom, when she was a girl, who put him out. This is not really given, I feel like, the sober weight that it should.
Yeah.
Considering it, this should be like, and I guess in the movie, maybe this is the knowledge that helps JD to start sympathizing with his mom. But one, it comes very late in his life. He's already a college student when he's learning a story that I know my family would have told many times over and over again by this point. But also that it's just kind of treated as like a pretty quick flashback when that's, again, like a horrifying thing.
I think the flashback structure of this movie is one of the deadliest parts of it. Like if we had seen a lot of this in sequence and allowed it to give time to breathe by cutting out that flashback stuff, like, yeah, it's important to understand that, you know what, Amy Adams went through a lot of trauma as a child, which obviously contributed to her current state, and things are more complex than they seem. And this also gets into a section of the movie. I mean, I guess I'm skipping ahead a little bit, but like Glenn Close's character kind of becomes like, oh, she's like the tough love, like center of this movie. She's the one who's ultimately kind of going to like help the main character get out of this life. But she is shown as being kind of a shitty parent herself. Like there's a story there in like someone who was a bad parent, realizes it, tries to be a better parent to their grandchild. And if it's given time to breathe and you see the complexity of that character, that would be good. But Glenn Close is seen mostly like yelling at this kid. And we see that she got like, she like set her husband on fire earlier. So it's hard to look at her as like the avatar, like the center of morality in this movie that I think the movie kind of wants us to.
I think there's an interesting movie, a better movie there about a woman who is a bad mom but becomes a great grandma.
Yeah.
Much the opposite way that you could be a bad grandpa, like in the movie Bad Grandpa, when by all accounts he seems to have been a fine dad.
Now, where does a bad mom's Christmas fit into this scenario?
Now, they're like, those
well,
moms,
the second
they're not
movie,
really
Dan.
Bad, you know.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, that does fit. It is the second movie. But like, they're not bad like Mama set your husband on fire bad.
Right.
They're bad like, oh, let's be bad. Let's order more. Let's let her 2 desserts.
Mm-hmm.
Like that kind of, like, not the sinful, I'm going to go to hell because I've committed, you know, avarice and I've profaned the Lord, but more like sinfully decadent.
Right. So wait, is the first one is the cast of the Bad Moms franchise. Is that right, Elliot?
Yeah.
Or are you describing a series of movies that you, I'm guessing, haven't seen?
No, no, I'm describing a series of movies I've had relayed to me secondhand in detail.
Yeah.
But I'm guessing the Bad Moms movies are not about them abusing their children and being... I don't think it is. I feel like I'm safe in saying that the Bad Moms are bad in the same way that Bad Teacher is bad or Bad Santa is bad, where it's like, I'm breaking all the rules. But they're not really... They're not breaking so many rules that they're going to
prison. Yeah, they're not
prison.
Bad lieutenants.
Bad teacher is worse than yes. bad moms, and bad Santa is worse than either of them. Bad moms are, like, they're mostly just bad moms because they refuse to, like, make baked goods for the PTA.
Exactly. But whereas, like Stuart says, they're not as bad as bad lieutenant.
No. No. Or bad lieutenant, Port of Call, New Orleans.
Or batter lieutenant.
I mean, it's the... batter... No, that's when the lieutenant was fried in batter. Delicious. Anyway, so... JD finally tells his mom about his girlfriend, and they flash back to when his mom, and this is something, another one of those things that comes as a huge surprise since they never mentioned it before, apparently married her boss, who became JD's stepdad, and this stepdad is hilariously just kind of like a bland, awkward stepdad.
Yeah.
He's allergic to dogs, so JD cannot keep his dog, and his new stepbrother is like, hey, you want to smoke pot with me? And that's like, uh-oh,
yeah,
watch out.
They
this
smoke
is
a bunch of
kid.
Weed, and the stepbrother's got a record of Dimension Hate Tross by Voivod on the wall. I mean, this kid's fucking cool, dude.
Yeah, he's a bad boy. But like a bad mom's bad boy. Not like a Jeffrey Dahmer bad boy. That's a bad boy.
That's true.
Like, that's as bad as boys get.
I mean, I guess that's...
Boys do not get much badder than that.
I guess you win this one, Elliot, with your Jeffrey Dahmer bad boy line.
So, like, when I saw the movie Bad Boys, I was like, these boys are going to be bad. And then it was like, oh, okay, they're just kind of like dangerous, I guess. They don't follow
all
the rules.
I mean, they do drive through an entire shanty town in Cuba and seem to be happy to crack jokes about it while it's happening.
I mean, that's bad. That's bad bad behavior.
Yeah.
But at the same point, also, they're men. Those are bad men.
That's
and
true.
It's okay to, like, it's easy to laugh at a bad boy. It is not easy to laugh at a bad man. A bad man is trouble.
Nah, or a Batman.
A Batman is very easy to laugh at because he's like, oh, this is my voice now. And it's like, there's no way that's your real voice. Come on.
Yeah.
No one talks like that. Anyway, mom, she asks JD for a urine sample so she doesn't lose her job because she has been using drugs again. And he's like, no way. You should lose your job. And mama is like, no, family is all that matters. You pee in that cup. And JD is like, you're both bad moms. And I don't mean like bad moms Christmas. I mean like your moms who are detrimental to my upbringing. And he pees in the cup and does it. But JD is having his own troubles. He's failing at algebra because he doesn't have a graphing calculator. And this is one of those times where it's like, I know you don't know to ask and you're ashamed of your poverty, but his teacher is giving him bad grades because does not have a piece of equipment he cannot afford. And it's like, I feel like this is one of those times where he's going to be like, teacher, I can't afford this.
And the teacher
calculator.
Would have been like, well, sell that Lord of the Pit, idiot.
And there's like, this is a, you know, this is not a wealthy part of the school. I mean, like the country. So, you know, presumably they don't have a lot of money for their own school supplies. So there's that. But they do expect kids to have these expensive graphing calculators. So it doesn't really jive. It seems like they would have one or two around to like loan out to more.
I mean, growing up,
I remember
having to have one of those, and I remember hearing how much it costs and being like, what the fuck? Does it drive the car for me? Does it pick me up on time from soccer practice, mom?
Your 1980s stand-up graphing calculator material.
Yeah, I'm testing it out here on the Flophouse.
So that you can send yourself back in time through Skynet to do it when it was most relevant.
Yeah.
Skynet's like, look, I'm about spreading smiles through time now instead of causing violence. I've made my peace. All my talk with Dr. Susan Calvin has really paid off. So, Stuart, I want to bankroll your time-traveling comedy tour. The problem with it is you keep having to go back further and further in time to when people haven't heard the jokes yet. So, and also, you know, if he gets that graphing calculator, he's just going to play the games on it. Someone's going to give him Drug War, one of those other text-based graphing calculator games.
Yeah.
And he's going to end up spending his whole study hall doing that. Anyway, but even worse, he lets his stepbrother's no-good friends use Mama's car to go to a Home Depot and just kind of smash it up, and they crash the car on the way back. That's being a bad boy. Like, that's real bad boy stuff. As in, like, you shouldn't do that. 2011, This scene I wasn't originally going to mention, but it does have Oscar yelling scene number 6, where they go to Amy Adams' current boyfriend's house to get her stuff, and it's just a shouting match.
Yeah.
And JD is screaming at this guy through the door and is going to break the door down until a neighbor is like, stop it, I have children, what are you doing? Yeah. And I guess that's JD slipping back into the morass of his old family ways. You know, they're pulling him down.
What he did is he triggered his berserk barbarian rage class ability, and you're like, fuck, well, I've already used the ability for the day. I might as well get in a battle. Otherwise,
yeah,
I love how the secret story of Hillbilly Elegy is how much it intersects with gaming. Yeah,
I do want to briefly address the character of JD, who is not much of a character in his own story. I think there are side characters who the movie would profit more by spending its time on. But like, is he like, what do we think of him? Because like, I have sympathy for anyone who grew up under difficult circumstances and had like such a trying family life. At the same time, he does seem to spend a lot of the movie like being a dick in his own way and like shoving his problems away and not like telling people what's going on, like not ever explaining to anyone what's happening. What do you think?
Well, yeah.
Well, that's kind of what he needs to learn. That's the lesson he needs to learn, to rely on other people. But what were you going to say, Stuart?
I feel like you get the best sense of his character from his relationship with his girlfriend, Usha, who he takes advantage of, he is dishonest with, and he is generally not a very good boyfriend. And she is this, like, almost comically understanding character.
Yeah, she's
well. The scene that shows how much she loves him is when she's laughing at the way he says syrup instead of syrup, and it was like, is that what the relationship is built around?
Well,
that is not a strong foundation.
They love to bust each other's.
And this is the woman who eventually becomes his wife in real life. Yeah. I believe
they love to mess with each other, which immediately actually put me against this relationship because, like, well, early on she's studying in the library and he brings her food, which is sweet. But she is
Excuse me, sir. As the husband and son of different librarians, you do not bring food into the library.
No, I know, Elliot. My mom is a librarian as well, but I just or she was wow. before she retired.
What
but
a cool argument,
I'm just saying.
I'm just saying, if you want vermin eating away at the books, then go ahead, bring your lunch,
Elliot,
to the library.
Let me get to my actual point, which is, look, I understand that is meant to be read as like this sweet thing, and. And maybe it is like he's like, eat, you got to eat. But then she is understandably worried about the rules. She's like, no, we're in a library. And then he's like, he pushes her basically back into like the stacks. He's like, OK, you can eat here. I'll be your lookout. And then he does a bit where he pretends someone's coming and like, you know, she's going to get in trouble. And I'm like, this is not nice to like fuck with her. Like, come on. Like, this is supposed to be charming banter in the movie, I think, but it just comes off as, like, you're not respecting her worries, and then once she's like, oh, you know, I will eat, you're, like, fucking with her.
Mm-hmm.
It is true that in a movie that is supposed to be a heartfelt, real, like, gritty look at life, there is a lot of dialogue in it that smacks of that movie behavior where you're like, oh, if someone did this in real life, they would be a terrible person. This is a mean thing to do. It's got a little bit of that romantic comedy logic where you're like, this is cute in the movie, but if I did this, I would rightfully be shot.
Be arrested.
I mean, Meg Ryan had a perfectly nice fiance in Sleepless in Seattle. She didn't have to go start stalking Tom Hanks on his houseboat.
No, not at all. Well, this is also one of the problems I have with the movie Frozen, where there's a song in it where these trolls, who don't need to be in the movie anyway, are singing about how these two should obviously be in love, and the guy is like, I can't remember his name, whether it's Sven or... No, because Sven is the reindeer, right?
I can't remember.
Or Kristoff. I think it's Kristoff. He's like, but she's already engaged, and the trolls are like, hey, let's just get that fiancé out of the way, and you two can be together. And I was like, this is not a good lesson for kids, that you should just go and break up engagements if you feel like you're in love with that person.
I mean, if something better comes along, you got to trade up. That's the rule, right?
No, that's gaming again. Stuart, you're looking at life as a game again. That's not, you don't level up in relationships.
You only have so many inventory slots. Theoretically, you only have one fiancé slot. You might as well take the better fiancé.
I mean, very much not theoretically. Like, for most people, realistically, practically, there's only one spot. But anyway, 1997, JD's arguing with his mom, Oscar yelling number 7, and Mama, despite having pneumonia, leaves the hospital in order to get there and say JD's living with her from now on so that he won't get into trouble anymore and wreck her car. Back to 2011, JD's sister, who holds like 40 jobs and should be in many ways the star of the movie, she's the one who actually has like the weight of this life falling down on her, says she's not the one who escapes and goes to Yale and becomes a fancy lawyer and writes a best-selling book. JD's sister is like, Mom can't stay with me. Let's just put her in a hotel, and you should go to that interview in the next morning. And we flash to, which is, you know, it's we'll
That's
talk about
it.
It's like a voice of reason, but the lesson of the movie is also like abandon your family because you'll be better for them as a rich person than you are as a helping hand in the moment, which is, I don't know. It feels like the traditional storytelling method would be for them to turn their back on earthly riches in order to support the ones they love. But that's not the America we live in, I guess. And we flash back to Mama's throwing out JD's slacker friends. There's another argument, Oscar yelling number 8. This is firmly in the Mama is the like tough love coach section. JD gets caught trying to steal the calculator he needs. He learned it from his mom, stealing sports cards. Now he's stealing, you know, overpriced but relatively small consumer electronics.
And having been a Radio Shack store manager, I felt this moment deeply because shoplifting was like a constant, ever-present threat and danger to the point where at one point I was watching security footage and I saw a woman using her daughter's, like her little school-age daughter's book bag as a way to stash a camera she stole. And I was like, fuck this. I am not cut out for this life.
Yeah. I was going to ask how you handled...
And that's when you became a professional shoplifter. You were like, I'm on the wrong side
exactly,
of these cameras.
Yeah.
I was going to ask how you handled that, Stuart. I mean, like, I was wondering whether this got Radio Shack flashbacks because the one time I worked in a small enough retail store that like I was there to kind of witness any shoplifting, I briefly worked at a souvenir store in Savannah, Georgia, and this very like erratic
Dan, how have I not heard any stories about this part of your life before?
There are a couple fun
ones.
Did
you wear a straw hat?
This was when I thought I was going to maybe go to film school, and I actually was in film school for 3 months, and I dropped out. This was at SCAD, and I worked at this store that was actually connected to riverboat tours. It was where you bought the tickets for the riverboat tours and then got your like photos afterwards and souvenirs. But this very erratic-seeming guy came in one time, and me and the other guy who worked there, who was older, but we like bonded because we like would talk about horror movies, just like kind of watched it all happen. We're like, we're not intervening here.
Yeah.
Not like if this guy wants to steal a snow globe, go ahead.
But you decided your life or and injury was not
exactly.
worth that snow globe.
Yeah, there was definitely a time where a guy stole a fucking inbox new cell phone off the counter. And I chased after him for about half a block before I was like, what the fuck would I even do if I caught it?
Yeah.
Like, would I, like, slap the cuffs on him? Like, citizen's arrest? Yeah. Like, what the fuck? Like, I don't want to fight a guy.
That's the thing. I think legally there's not even really, like, what you're not going to
do. But it's this moment
anything,
like, of, like, I don't know, this feeling like, how dare this guy steal this thing from me? I don't know. It was dumb.
Exactly.
And, like, it was overwhelming and a little bit soul-crushing is how
and
I
you know
reacted
what, Stuart?
To it.
That's how Radio Shack failed. It got out of money because of that.
Yeah,
that loss.
That was the straw that broke Radio Shack's back.
Sorry,
yeah.
Guys.
It wasn't
sorry.
The fact that people don't need transistors anymore.
Sorry, the Shack.
That was one of Stuart Wellington's patented flash shacks. That's right. It's a Radio Shack flashback from Stuart Wellington. Patent pending, actually. JD gets caught trying to steal that calculator. Mama gets him out of the situation and buys it for him, but and starts yelling at him and gives him the speech about, are you going to try or you not? This Oscar yelling number 9. And JD is so mad he throws the calculator out the window, which is totally the kind of thing I would have done as a kid. I would have gotten so pissed that I just need to get that energy out. Although what would happen with us is that my mom would be yelling at me in the car and I would open the door of the car as if I was just going to jump out and roll out. And then she'd reach over and pull the door shut and pull the car over and yell at me for that.
You're a regular ladybird.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yep. Exactly. But then he notices that. So she has a hard time making ends meet. She gets Meals on Wheels, and she's really begging the Meals on Wheels delivery guy for extra food. And then she shares half it with him. And this is like one of the more. This is maybe to me the most powerful scene in the movie because it's not yelling. It's totally this character who up till now has been presented as like she's the strong, tough one in the family has to has to grovel and like make herself so abject and admit her poverty to this person in order to get what she needs to survive and for her grandson to survive. This was like, if more of the movie was in this manner, yes, of like matter-of-factiness and not yelliness, then it would be a different movie.
Elliot, I 100% agree with you. Like, this is the most affecting moment in the movie, partly because it's the only moment too where anyone's nice to one another. Like, the Meals on Wheels guy is very understanding and she is very grateful that he's understanding, but also just like, yeah, it is a quiet moment that really sinks in, you know, that this is a person who's struggling and is proud but wants to take care of her grandson.
And what's funny is the movie understands that, because narrative-wise, this is the thing that makes JD clean his shit up. And you're like, if the movie knows that, why is it filled with so much other bullshit?
That's true.
Why is it full of so many speeches that don't work? Is that the message? That, like, coming up with, little bits of, I don't know, like, grandstanding speeches don't actually serve any purpose and don't work? It's these little moments of kindness or little moments of humility and honesty that actually, you know.
You are searching for meaning where there is none, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, if the movie was aware of that as a message, it would be a really strong movie, and I would be like, oh, okay, I get what it's doing now. If it was like, all this yelling doesn't make the difference, but when you see someone as a human being and they touch you emotionally, I actually think it's almost like the movie stumbled into an affecting moment. I mean, I'm not saying stumbled. The people who made the movie are professionals. They know what they're doing. They've made great movies in the past. They just kind of like, they took the wrong road in this movie, and they briefly by accident ended up on the right on-ramp to the right road, and then they took another wrong turn. Maybe they needed gas, or they saw Denny's, and they're like, I know it's Denny's, but I'm hungry. Yeah. Like, I'm just going to stop there. And they kept going in their other way. JD, because he sees this, and he starts straightening up. He gets a job. He's working hard. He's trying at school. Suddenly he's doing great.
I think Man in Motion starts playing, right?
If only. What a needle drop that would be.
Yeah. It's probably.
Speaking of music, we haven't addressed the fact that
I think Saving the Day from Ghostbusters starts playing.
Speaking of music, we haven't addressed the fact that the main theme for this movie, written by Hans Zimmer, is basically like a straight lift of the Game of Thrones theme music. Like, it's totally that.
Is that what it was? I just heard a lot of strings and banjo, and I was like, I don't know. I checked out as soon as I started. There's a certain sort of like a folksy cornpone music that I kind of the same way with Wild Mountain Time. I was like, oh boy, I'm gonna hear a lot of fiddle in the background.
I barely watched that television show, and even I like started imagining like castles rising in the hollers of Kentucky.
Stuart, I can honestly tell you that the music made absolutely no impact on me whatsoever.
Wow, harsh rebuke of Hans Zimmer's work.
Now I wish. I mean, what are you, the producers of The Simpsons? Anyway, so, or is that Hans Zimmer or Alf Clausen? That was Alf Clausen. Now I wish that there were an opening title sequence where it was like Game of Thrones, and there's just like rundown houses with old trucks in front of them rising up in the forests, and that would be nice. Anyway, we go to the present of the movie 2011. JD catches his mom doing drugs in the hotel and flushes them down. And she's like, please stay with me during the night. And he's like, and he has this cavalcade of family flashbacks, which you think is going to lead him to choose his family over his career. But instead he's like, I can't help you unless I get a good job. I'll see you tomorrow, maybe, Mom.
This scene where he squirts out the heroin that was in the needle and then flushes the needle. And I was like, you can't flush a needle. And Charlene, like, just staring at the screen's like, yeah, you can. Made me a little bit nervous about who my wife really is, but whatever. It's not good for the pipes.
That's fair.
Yeah.
It is bad for the pipes. My life is a little bit more innocent. Yesterday, my toddler son was stuffing walnuts into a public drainage pipe in a park, and I was like, it's probably not good for that pipe.
But are they organic walnuts?
Yeah, they were organic malls. They were from a tree. But that he was, and I said, no, stop that. That's not good for that pipes. And he goes, no, it is. It is good. And I was like, there's no way. How do you know more about plumbing than me?
He's appeasing the mole people, Elliot.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing. If you stop him, it could be catastrophic.
Yeah.
Uh-oh. That would explain all the earthquakes in Los Angeles. The mole people are not getting enough walnuts. on the he's like, good luck, Mom. Good luck with your addiction. I got to go to this job interview. And he drives all night, his hands wet on the wheel, because there's a voice in his head that drives his heel. It's his baby calling. She says, I need you here. And he does call her on the drive and apologizes to his girlfriend. And she says, I'm going to stay up all night with you and keep you awake while you're driving. And
again, like bending over backwards to help this guy. This guy who can't seem to catch a break has probably the greatest break in a partner who is doing all this work for him.
Well, especially because, as we will see, she's willing to run like out of the apartment down to the job interview and be like, oh, we're going to be late, except for that's a trick.
It's a trick. He's like, I'm never going to make it. She goes, I'll run down and I'll tell them. And then she goes to the door and opens it. And JD's right there on the phone. He could have just walked in the house a couple minutes ago, but instead he decided to play this last little teaser prank on her, which is stupid.
And he had the time to set up the prank. So he must have been driving shockingly fast. Dangerously fast.
Now, I don't know why I wish now, this is going back to earlier in the movie when he called her for silverware help. I wish that it had become an Apollo 13 type scene, also directed by Ron Howard, where she was like, describe the place setting to me. And she was just pulling silverware from her own home to make a simulation place setting so that she could see what he was seeing and tell him what he could use. Mm-hmm. Guys, would that have been funny? It would have been too much.
I think it would have been too much. I would have preferred kind of a more modern approach where she closes her eyes and enters her own memory palace of going into...
Her memory restaurant? Which is, I guess, what you could call scenes from an Italian restaurant.
That's true.
So, okay. But the movie...
Anyway, so at the very end of the movie, JD gets to his interview, and then we get a VO about how he owes everything to his family, and then it's just like... after movie text about how he's been super successful and now everybody's doing great. Mm-hmm. And the message of the movie is they are no longer just a bunch of poor hillbillies. Now they are some rich Hill Williamses.
Yep.
You're not allowed to make that face when you make that joke, Elliot.
And again,
wait, let me make it some more. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
This is one final way I feel like the framing unbalances this movie because it makes him getting this law job the ultimate triumph. And I feel like it, like, not only is the message of this movie, like the political message of this movie, kind of non-existent, the emotional message of the movie to me is kind of incomprehensible because it makes a big, like, part of the movie is always about, like, oh, family is the most important thing. Family is the most important thing. So that could be like a fine message for a movie. I don't know if I necessarily agree with it, but it's fine. Or the message of the movie could be what it ultimately kind of points at, like, some people can't be helped. Sometimes you need to, like, be good to yourself and understand that. Like, you do what you can, but then let it go. But the way the movie ends, putting so much weight on this, like, job, makes it really feel like, okay, the message of the movie is leave your drug-addicted mom behind and get a high-powered lawyer job.
Yeah, like, you owe everything your family, so jettison them like a booster rocket
exactly.
That got you out of the atmosphere, because they are useless to you now. They are so many tons of space junk that are just weighing you back.
Yeah, I mean, I think on some level it's going for the idea that, like, in order to move forward in as a human, you need to understand where you come from and come to grips with your past trauma, and that should let you, you know, I don't know, self-actualize or something. I don't know.
Yeah, that is an excellent message that I could not find in this.
That's
movie.
The thing. I feel like their reach is shorter than their goals.
Yeah, their arms are too short to box with, not God exactly, but certainly Leon Spinks for sure.
Hercules maybe.
Hercules, yeah. It definitely, it feels like a movie made by someone justifying why it was okay for them to leave their drug addicted mom in a hotel room while they drove away to New Haven to interview for a fancy job.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's just do final judgments on this movie, whether it's a good, bad movie, a bad, bad movie, a movie we kind of liked. Before I get into mine, I just want to say, like, look, I grew up in a small town. We were not wealthy, but we certainly did not. I've never... in my life had to, like, feel financially insecure in the way that these people have or dealt with so much hardship. So if I've said anything foolish along the way, I apologize. I know that I've had a privileged way of it, but this movie, oh boy, it's not good, folks. Not good, folks. It's just, like, a lot of, like, very competent to good effort has been put into making the movie, but the movie just shouldn't have been made in this form. It feels deeply confused. I have no idea why this movie was made other than to show us sort of a parade of misery.
Yeah, it feels like the movie was described to me ahead of time as poverty porn, and it feels like that often, which is, if anything, the worst kind of porn, mm-hmm. I'm guessing.
You can barely masturbate to it.
Barely. If you're a bear, you can do it. But good bears can masturbate
come
to anything.
Good things come in bears. Uh-huh. I know that. So if you can come damn, please stop, as a please bear. Stop.
I don't like that you're making this your new motto. but I second what Dan said. I did come from a privileged middle class upbringing. I lived in an affluent town, so I apologize if I was misunderstanding the life of the underprivileged. But as a movie, it is unaffecting, and it seems very mixed up and not. Yeah. The movie does not seem quite sure of what it is doing or what it is trying to get at, and is hoping that if it just muddles along, it'll get there. So I would call it. Best picture, probably. Stuart, what
okay,
do you say?
Okay, so it's my turn. So the first thing I do is I apologize. So
apologize for something other than what we apologize for.
No, I just,
for.
To
new
I just
thing.
Wanted to acknowledge that, like, we're talking not necessarily from a place of expertise about some of this. That's uh-huh. all.
Also, I'm a big dumb idiot, so I say dumb stuff mm-hmm. all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, Stuart is coming from an expertise in the realm of collectible card
games.
Yeah,
I guess so. That's true. Yeah, I guess so. So, yeah, I can put Esquire on my business card. My business card, of course, being a rare Magic the Gathering trading card that I am willing to hand people because I have so many. This is a bad, bad movie. It feels wrongheaded. Structurally, it doesn't quite make sense. It doesn't really seem to have any kind of a message. And... yeah, I mean, it feels like a collection of, like, Oscar swing scenes thrown together. And, yeah, I mean, it's just, yeah, no thank you.
No thank you.
Bad, bad.
No thank you, but no thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you.
No thanks. Problem.
These are real podcast listeners, not actors.
What do you look for in a podcast?
Reliability is big for me.
Power.
I'd say comfort.
What do you think of this?
Oh.
That's Jordan, Jesse, Go.
Jordan, Jesse, Go?
They came out of the floor?
And down from the ceiling?
That can't be safe.
I'm upset.
Can we go now?
Soon. Jordan, Jesse, Go. A real podcast.
I started listening to Ono, Ross, and Carrie shortly after I broke my arm.
I couldn't get my book started.
I was lost, honestly.
I knew it was time to make a change.
There's something about Ono, Ross, and Carrie that you just can't get anywhere else.
They're thought leaders, discoverers, founders.
I'd call them heroes.
Ross and Carrie don't just report on fringe science, spirituality, and claims of the paranormal. They take part themselves.
They show up so you don't have to.
But you might find that you want to.
Arm is better.
I wrote an entire book this weekend. It's terrible, but I did it.
Just go to MaximumFun.org.
Thank you, Ross and Carrie.
Ono, Ross and Carrie is just a podcast. It doesn't do anything. It's just sounds you listen to in your ears. All these people are made up. Goodbye.
Hey, guys. It's just a quick solo drop-in by Dan. We forgot to mention on our original recording that you can still see the Flophouse live show for another couple of days. If you didn't see it live, if you didn't buy a ticket before, you can still buy a ticket now. Watch the show, the recorded version of it, and that will be available, I believe, until midnight on February the 14th, midnight on Valentine's Day. You could cuddle up with someone and watch the Flophouse talk about Teen Wolf. What could be more romantic? And the new shirts, the beautiful shirts, the Rocket Crocodile one and the one of all of us as teen wolves or middle-aged man wolves will be available until the end of that period as well. So if you still want to take a moment and watch that live show before February the 14th at midnight, when it will expire, like Cinderella's coach. You can go get tickets at theflophouse.simpletix.com. Theflophouse.simpletix.com. And if you want one of the new shirts, the Rocket Crocodile shirt, or the Teen Wolves Flophouse shirt, you can go to www.bonfire.com/store/Flophouse Tour Store. Thank you to the person who emailed me saying that I should use, shorter, easier to understand URLs. You are correct. I did not set them up, though, so don't always assume that everything that is done wrong at the Flophouse is done because of me. But in the future, we'll have better, easier to understand or remember URLs. But the store is, again, www.bonfire.com/store/Flophouse Tour Store. Now back to the regular show. Okay, so let's...
Guys, I think we can call this one Hillbilly Elegy Elegy.
Not Shillbilly Smellegy.
That would be the Mad Magazine version of it.
If only.
Oh, I want to see that so badly now.
Yeah. So, the Flophouse is sponsored in part by Squarespace. If you use Squarespace's services, you can create a beautiful website to promote or just get your cool idea out there, blog or publish content, sell products and services of all kinds, and much, much more. Squarespace does this by giving you beautiful, customizable templates created by world-class designers, everything optimized for mobile right out of the box, a new way to buy domains and choose from over 200 extensions, free and secure hosting. Hey, why don't you go over, if this interests you, to squarespace.com/flop for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, use the offer code FLOP to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
Hey guys, I had an idea for a website kind of based on today's movie, and I was wondering if Squarespace might be able to help us, and Dan, maybe,
oh, wow.
Maybe you can help me.
Kind of came out of nowhere, but that's okay.
Yeah, so I was wondering, we see so many warm weather hillbillies.
Mm.
They live in the South, it's much warmer there. But I was wondering, what about the colder hillbillies? And that's why at www.chillbilly.com, you can find your news about the chilliest billies. That's right, hillbillies who live in cold areas, and again, we call them chillbillies. They also are super cool, not just cold, and that's why they chill. So at chillbillies.com, it's your place online for cold weather, rural, poverty line stereotypes.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Is this like sure. a meetup site, or is it like is it like fiction? What's going on?
Yeah, no, well, I mean, the meetup site is our app, Bilble, which is that's for a hillbilly meetup site. But it's just a place where you can swap stereotypes, make crude caricatures, and pretend to be them in multi-million dollar movies for award consideration. So that's chillbilly.com, and use offer code. We don't have one. There's nothing to buy on the site. So
I suddenly got the site really worried about these made-up URLs that you do, Elliot. This is one of the ones that I feels like it might actually exist, and I'm.
It might exist. Well, Jordan, if this one exists, please cut this part out. And if it doesn't exist, please
buy that domain
for me. Yeah.
Guys,
I just checked. www.chillbilly.com is for sale.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So
we're safe.
It is available.
We're safe.
Okay. Let me see if I have enough money on these 5 credit cards.
Now there is another. Now I want it. This is a movie idea. This is not a show. But I was worrying about Chilly Willy Elegy, which would be the story of Chilly Willy's upbringing and how difficult
penguin,
it was.
The cartoon penguin. This is the one.
This is the cartoon penguin, uh-huh. Chilly Willy. Okay. Yeah.
This is what, like a dirge you sing after his passing?
Yeah, exactly.
Tales of his adventures.
The Skald sings because it at his Viking funeral.
Well, because he's gone from the cold of Antarctica to the ultimate cold of the grave.
Yeah, all right. Well, let's move on to letters. Unless, wait, Elliot, you look like you might have something to plug.
I do have something to plug. In stores now, that's right, because it came out Wednesday, February 3rd, which again is after recording this, but before it will be released, is number one of Maniac of New York. That's right, Maniac of New York, number one from Aftershock Comics by me and Andrea Muti. It's the story of basically what if The Wire was, instead of being about drugs, was about Jason Voorhees, and is set in New York City. So there's an unstoppable killer. He's been a problem in New York for years. Everyone's kind of given up except for two crusading people, a mayoral aide and an outcast police officer, police detective. And they're going to try to take this monster, this slasher killer down. Will they be able to do it? Find out in Maniac of New York, number one from Aftershock Comics, in stores now. Go to your local comic book store or mail order it for them if you don't want to go out of the house, which I understand.
And real quick, Dan, when's this episode dropping?
This episode, 1 second, should come out on the 13th of February.
Okay, so that
the day
means,
before Valentine's.
Yeah, that means as a special Valentine's Day gift for yourself or others, it is the last, if you're listening to this on the day it drops, it is the last day for our limited run, our exclusive run of live show t-shirts. If you go to the Flophouse Pod Twitter account, you'll find links to those shirts there. They are great. And they're exclusive to just that week. So if you miss them, you miss them. So hopefully you got a chance to grab one.
These are some great designs. I've liked our past designs, but these are my favorite designs that we've ever had.
Oh, wow.
They're really good.
They are very good designs. But let us move on to...
Dan's favorite subject.
Mm-hmm.
But...
let us move on.
Oh, God, you got him. Oh, shit. Oh,
that's
man.
So,
caught
that's
him.
So Raven.
Stick a fork in him.
Now, okay, so letters from listeners like you. This one's from John, last name withheld.
Mm-hmm. John Lasseter, no, Pixar.
Well, there's no, no.
There's no, I hope not.
There's no H, so I can only assume it's new to Twitter, John Stewart.
Yeah.
Hey, Peaches, my daughter, 13, also an avid listener. I don't recommend that, but.
Your daughter's name is 13? That's cool.
Yeah. Very similar to the character 3 from Peanuts. Remember that? When there was a character who just had a number as their name? Anyway.
I kind of remember it. Not particularly. Are you thinking of Pigpen?
No. There was a whole, like, gag. It was basically the early 1960s Charles Schulz version of making fun of, like, kids have the craziest names these mm-hmm. days.
They don't have good names like Linus
or Schroeder
or Shermie. Whatever happened to normal kid names like Shermie?
My daughter 13.
Wait, no, Dan. I always assume Schroeder was his last name. Do you think it's his first name?
No, I think it's his last name. I think you're right there. My daughter 13. There are two Patties in that strip. There's Peppermint Patty and regular Patty. That seems.
I mean, that's.
Well, that's why they call her Peppermint Patty, Dan. To
they
keep
do
them
the
apart.
Same thing on The Bachelor. When there's multiple patties, one's regular Patty, one's Peppermint Patty.
This seems like Charles Schulz could have come up with a different name, but anyway. My daughter, 13, also an avid listener, is thinking about making a movie for a community student film competition. Uh-huh. Her idea is a comedy horror movie. Something along the lines of Jaws meets Scary Movie starring our cat as Jaws. Mm-hmm. Question mm-hmm. to you filmic geniuses is, what are your best tips to make the plot beats hit the best for making dumb gore work and be funny? And any other tips for making a horror comedy short, 15-minute tops, hit the best? Yours in floptasticness, John, last name withheld.
It sounds like she should definitely make this mm-hmm. movie. There is no reason not to make a movie if you want to make a movie. And my first tip, sorry to jump in, guys, ahead of time. My first tip would be to, like, not worry about the plot that much. Like, for a short, it's going to be more important to you probably to just keep it entertaining and funny and keep uh-huh. the energy moving. And you don't want to get bogged down with plot stuff, you know? Keep the plot as simple and straightforward as you can, unless the joke is that the plot is really complicated. And then just have fun making it fun.
From what little I've learned from watching TikToks, the key is editing. If you want to get laughs, make it do a lot of quick editing.
Yeah, edits cuts are funny. Like, there are certain types of things that are funny and without cuts, but a lot of times a quick cut is funny.
Yes, if you make the cut part of the joke, I actually was going to say another thing, which is a little bit opposed, but I think. I trust our listeners to be smart enough to hold both ideas in their head, which is sometimes it is funnier to also just let things play out and long, like a slapstick thing. Often just like seeing the full thing is the funny way, and modern movies have forgotten that.
Oh, I will say that's true. Slapstick is funnier without cuts.
It's like the scenes in Children of Men where Alfonso Cuarón just does one long take. Those were hilarious.
That movie was so funny. That's why Birdman is hilarious. That's why The Revenant is hilarious. That's why Rope is hilarious. Russian Ark, yeah, is a laugh fucking riot. Sorry that your daughter had to hear me curse just then. But let the moment tell you how best it should be made. Don't stick to a theory, but let the moment tell you. But I would still just say, like, make it as fun to watch as you can, and don't worry. Like, the best movies, the ones that people remember the most, people very rarely remember how the plot goes.
Yeah.
This is something that Howard Hawks believed in, was he said, people don't watch movies for plots, they watch them for scenes, and they remember scenes, they don't remember plots. I think he went too far with that until eventually he was making movies that were just about dudes hanging out at racetracks or hanging out on a safari. But you need some plot, but don't worry that the plot is going to be the thing that, like, makes or breaks you.
Yeah, you know? if you got interesting gags in it, I don't know, I'm remembering now, there was a video I was supposed to make for French class in high school, and it was not supposed to be horror, but because I'm who I am, I'm like, I'm going to put some horror stuff in there. And it was like a French class video where it involved me accidentally cutting my arm off, and I made one of those things where, like, there's a fake... I used an old shirt, and I made, like, a fake forearm to put on my real arm, and then I put a glove around it. I don't know why my character's wearing a glove, but so it looked like the glove was fake, but it looked like my hand holding my real arm. I hope that explanation made sense to people listening. And then out of my little stump, I had one of those squirt bottles, and I just, like, squirted blood out of it. So I guess my advice is do something like that.
Yeah, that sounds great.
And so what was what was French about it?
Oh, we were speaking in French.
Okay. You're like, oh, mon stump.
Yeah, Elliot, yeah, you don't think French people can get their arms cut off?
You're right. French people are just as likely as anyone else to get their arms cut off. Very fair.
We got one last email here. It's from Ben Last Name Withheld, who says...
Ben 10.
We all know that Psycho Gorman is the next Star Wars, both in the breadth of its cultural impact and in that every background character will eventually have at least 12 extended universe books about them. Stuart, until then, what can you tell us about Tube Man's backstory? Where did he go to high school? What are his goals, his dreams? What does he smell like when they pop that helmet off? For the rest of the floppers left in the shadow of Stewart's artistic legacy, what character with little screen time do you wish for more backstory on? I'm sorry I did not send you this last part of the question. I forgot
there. Cool. Yeah, cool.
I'm sorry.
Man, that's... I mean, this is tough. When I inhabit a role, I just let it kind of take, that character spirit inhabit me, as opposed to like to flow into my body and then out of my mouth, because I'm mainly a voice actor. I try not to overthink it too much. I'm kind of primal, almost animalistic when I perform. You guys have seen it, right? Where I'm like, I do that like little ritual where I growl a little bit, and I have to take my shirt off. The pants stay on. I'm not a Winnie the Pooh. I keep the pants on, but I do.
No, you're a Mickey Mouse.
I do roll the cuffs of my pants up a little bit so that it gives me the impression of having nudity on the bottom half of my body without actually, going all the way into it. So I do all that, and then I kind of I move around and I get very tactile. I touch everything and I make faces, kind of like if I was an animal, what an animal would do. And doing that takes me to this kind of like. It takes my brain to this kind of like lower, almost like subconscious. And that allows the character, in this case, Tube Man, to just kind of flow in through my ears and then just passes my brain entirely and flows right out of my mouth. So that's what I do.
Wow. As to the question of backstories, this may be cheating, but I'm going to just sort of rail against the idea that side characters need backstories at all.
What?
Well, like, part of it is, like, I think that there's this, I think it's kind of a modern affliction where people seem to start feeling like not knowing about every single character is a flaw rather than, like, part of what makes movies work. Like it is good to find something mysterious about this, like, to imagine whatever you can imagine is much greater. Like, I rewatched Pee-wee's Big Adventure with friends recently, and there's a scene in there where apparently originally there was a whole backstory to Amazing Larry, like why there's this guy who has this colorful mohawk in the scene in the basement where Pee-wee's laying out all the clues. But he works so much better just as, like, he's whispering something and Pee-wee says, "Is there something you can share with the rest of us, Amazing Larry?" And, like, the shocked cut to this guy with a crazy mohawk. And you're like, whatever backstory you have for Amazing Larry is better than, like, finding out in that deleted scene.
Yeah, I think it is. I was talking to someone recently about how if Disney made Snow White and the Seven Dwarves now, they'd be like, great, perfect. We're announcing movies for each of the dwarves. Mm. Then we'll do the prequel. We find out how they met each other. And it's not anything that we don't need that stuff. That being said, in the beginning of Singing in the Rain, there's a actress named Zelda who shows up at the movie premiere. And this guy in the crowd hops to his feet and goes, "Ah, Zelda! Ah!" And every time we see him, my family laughs and laughs. So I want to know what that guy's about and whether he brings that same level of enthusiasm to everything else.
Oh, yeah, you don't
want to
know more about Zelda. You just want to know about the guy.
I want to know about that guy who's just like, his eyes are popping out of his head. He's so excited to see her.
Yeah, I don't want to say too much about this. I'm going to go back on what I said a little bit. I don't want to say too much about this because I've been toying with writing, like, a humor piece about it for a while. Like, it's been in the back of my head. But
no, don't give away the trade secrets, Dan.
I just want to know the story of the guy in It's a Wonderful Life who sits down by the lever that opens the gymnasium pool and what his deal is, why he's hanging out there waiting for someone to, like, be like, "Hey, you know, you're jilted by your woman, huh? You know, there's a pool under here that you could open up." Like, what's his story?
He just loves swimming.
Yeah.
They don't get to use that pool very much.
Let's get into recommendations, movies you definitely should watch instead of Hillbilly Elegy. And I want to recommend something related to this movie in a way, thematically.
It's called Deliverance. Damn, no, come on.
It's called Wrong Turn 2.
Another Wrong Turn.
I am
Guys, you'll never believe this. I think we took another Wrong Turn.
I mean, that's the premise of the movie, Elliot.
I'm surprised that this hasn't been officially recommended on the podcast before, but my Googling says it has not. The Florida Project does everything right that this movie does wrong about, you know, showing people who are in dire financial straits. Like, it has a lot of sad stuff in it, but it has a lot of joy. It is presented, you know, very matter-of-factly, the day-to-day lives. You have characters who are doing occasionally dumb or unsympathetic things because they are stuck in a situation that sort of, like, doesn't allow for them to make mistakes, unfortunately. And it is, like, filled with quiet moments and humor and joy along with the dramatic stuff. And I think it paints a much more sort of full and sympathetic picture of what it is to be forced to live life, you know, in such a precarious way. Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
I
Florida
love
Project.
Yeah, I love that movie. It's like, not just because for some of the, like, filmmaking feats that they managed to accomplish, but also, like, Willem Dafoe's performance is so great. And also the performance from the children, who I'm assuming they did not realize they were, like, playing characters in a movie, right? Like,
knew they were playing characters. I knew they were playing characters, but they got natural performances. Uh-huh.
I'm sure they utilize a similar method to what I use when I do performing.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I mean, I don't think it was one of those things where they like hypnotized them and were like, this is your life now.
Is that a thing that happens?
it's how they got some of Grace Kelly's best performances out of her.
Yeah, you go, Elliot.
Okay, I'm going to recommend a movie also about, I guess, expensive academic situations.
Perfect, okay.
So I guess that connects to it. This is a movie that's on Amazon right now. It's called Sela and the Spades, and it was written and directed by Tyresha Poe. And it's set at a kind of like fancy boarding school where there's five, like kind of five family type setup where there's groups of students that kind of run the student body. And our main character, Sela, is the leader of a group called the Spades, who are in charge of drugs and other illicit substances. And it's kind of about her as someone who is trying to maintain this facade of just total composure and confidence all the time while she is up against the pressures of this kind of criminal social life and also the pressures from home to be like the best student she can be and not get into trouble. And she becomes friends with a younger student who she decides is going to be her her heir in this position, but then starts to have a falling out with her when her suspicions grow. And the movie, like, it starts off and it feels like it's going to be kind of like a Wes Anderson-y type thing, which I like Wes Anderson-y stuff, but I worry that other people can't quite pull it off. And then it does not become that at all. It feels very much like a movie that could have been about its plot, but is instead about these characters existing and interacting. And there are a number of scenes that where I was like, oh, this really feels like what it's like to be a teenager and have to kill time or be excited about something or be like worried about something. I thought it was it's more elliptically told than I thought it might be. And I thought it was really affecting that way. So I would say Sela and the Spades, if you want to see kind of like a teen movie that feels more poetic than your normal teen movie with a plot like that might sound.
Okay. And I'm going to recommend a movie. Let's tie this to Hillbilly Elegy. This is a movie about...
We know it's Psycho Gorman, Stu. Just go.
Complicated relationship between grandparents and children. Uh-huh. I'm going to recommend a movie on Shudder called Anything for Jackson. It's a horror movie about an older couple who they kidnap a pregnant woman in order to perform a reverse exorcism and bring back their grandson. And it's a funny, well-made, well-performed, very efficient scare machine. It is just by like scares per moment, you're going to get more than your average horror movie. I recommend it. It's a lot of fun. Yeah, give it a shot. Anything for Jackson.
Good SBM score.
Yeah, the SBM score is super high. If you're looking for just like a fun horror movie night, I think it's a great choice.
I will put it on my watch list. But
okay, Dan. I mean, I noticed that you very prominently did not say I'll put it on my watch list after my recommendation.
You sounded like a you know, maybe too good.
Yeah, a lot of vegetables.
Yeah.
No, but it's a good movie. All right, okay, how do I make it sound trashier? And one of them is a murderer who has a demon in her butt.
Okay,
and
well, now you're...
And so it's telling her to like to kill everybody, but it's at a carnival. It's like a haunted carnival.
If it was
carnival.
Dan Elliott, you should be pitching it at like a haunted girls' boarding school.
Okay, yeah, fair. It's at a haunted girls' pillow fight academy.
Okay. You have my interest.
It's called Saint Nighty's Academy.
So I'm going to make an effort for once to see if I can end this podcast quickly and efficiently.
Okay.
And say,
Dan, just pretend this podcast is your drug addicted mom in a hotel room and just say goodbye and drive off to New Haven.
We'd like to thank Jordan Cowling for editing the show. We would like to thank everyone at Maximum Fun for having us on their network. Why not go over to MaximumFun.org, check out the other podcasts on there. I listen to several of them myself. They are a well-curated, wonderful bunch. And if you have the time, please spread the word about the Flophouse wherever you think it might be effective. But until next time, I've been Dan McCoy.
I'm Stuart Wellington.
I'll be Elliot Kalin next time, too.
Bye.
Bye.
On this episode, we discuss Hillbilly Elegy,
the latest installment in the Barney Google Snuffy Smith cinematic universe.
Also yeah. pretty good. Mine is more, you know, contemporary with all the cool teens listening to Rob Zombie now.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.